From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Turn the clock back on this planet 500 or 600 years, and you'd never guess that the West was about to rule. China was grand, the Ottomans were rising, Europe was a bloody, backward mess. But the tide turned. Historian Neil Ferguson says now the tide is moving again, and the West looks to be in trouble. From a shaky Europe to a struggling USA, this hour On Point historian Neil Ferguson on the fate of the West. A special welcome today to our newest listeners in the great state of Maine, Maine Public Broadcasting. We're glad you're here. Joining me now in the studio is Neil Ferguson, professor of history at Harvard University, senior research fellow at Oxford, and at the Hoover Institution at Stanford, a conservative, one-time Thatcherite historian who swings for the fences in big, provocative books, Empire, Colossus, The Ascent of Money. His latest is Civilization, the West, and the Rest. Neil Ferguson, welcome back to On Point.
Nice to be here, Tom.
Let's start way back. Give us a kind of tour of the horizon you do in the book. 1411, the year 1411, what does the world look like?
If you'd gone on a world tour 600 years ago, you would have been far more impressed by the East than by the West. If you had gone to Ming China, you would have encountered a flourishing, sophisticated imperial system. You would, by contrast, have found a rather miserable state of affairs in a fragmented Europe, prone not only to plague but to civil war, and with a really measurably lower standard of living in a lot of ways. One good indication of this is that cities were much bigger in the East than in the West. You had a population of 500,000 in the Ming capital, Nanjing, in 1411. The population of London at that time was probably around 50,000, and it was a smelly
a mere burg.
Right, and the Ming were just about to embark on their great project of turning Beijing into the capital, building the Forbidden City. Mm-hmm. The Ottomans, if you'd sort of carried on your tour to the Near East, were not too far away from conquering Constantinople, turning it into present-day Istanbul. And the picture in Western Europe would have seemed pretty unpromising. There wasn't much sign at that point that Western Europe was going to emerge from its post-Roman slough of despond. There'd been about a millennium of underachievement.
The Dark Ages.
Well, that phrase, which is a little unfashionable, still, I think, nicely captures the poor economic performance and political instability that characterized Western Europe even into the early 15th century.
And yet, here we go. So if you're 1411, 600 years ago, that's what you see 500 years ago, things beginning to bubble and change. And then half a millennium, 500 years of the West, if you want to look at it in terms of dominance, you've got to look at the West as dominant in these years. Now, you say this book is no triumph of the West. It's just looking at what happened. Why did the West, and you say, we may be in decline now, you traveling in China and thinking back on the West, and it sure looks like decline from China, could even collapse in a rapid way. So we've got to look back at what made it rise in the first place. What did?
Well, I want to emphasize that it's really institutions and ideas that explain the extraordinary predominance the West achieved after around 1500. Let me spell it out crystal clear. It wasn't some kind of innate cultural, much less racial superiority. It wasn't the weather. It wasn't the geography. It was changes in institutions that propelled the West into a position of dominance. What do I mean by dominance? Let me also spell that out. Some people are really uncomfortable with this idea, but I think it's incontestable. By the time you get to the mid-20th century, the average Westerner is about 20 times richer than the average Resterner. I mean, if you just take per
capita... Resterner as in the rest of the world.
The rest of the world. Mm-hmm. If you just look at per capita income, which is a fairly straightforward measure of living standards, it's an enormous gap. And that gap had grown steadily from around 1500 right the way down, actually, to the 1970s, which is the peak of the great divergence. It's also there in longevity. People in the West started to live a lot longer than people in the rest of the world by the early 20th century, almost twice as long. And of course, you've got the phenomenon of the great Western empires, a dozen of which control by 1913 somewhere in the region of 60% of the world's land surface and population, and probably three quarters, if not more, of world gross domestic product. So the dominance seems to me absolutely incontrovertible. That's a reality. But explaining it is the hard bit. And there have been lots of attempts to do this. In some ways, civilization is a synthesis on my part. Number one, I think, has to do with the benefits of political and economic fragmentation. It turned out that
warring states of Europe were somehow an advantage?
It was a mixed blessing at times, but what one can see is that competition between multiple states, particularly over trade routes, was the starting point of the great divergence. It's the fact that in China, the emperor can prohibit oceanic navigation. Many of your listeners will
know
this.
And did after a point.
Right. So after the death of the Yongle emperor, Admiral Zheng He is just told, game over. You can't sail to Africa anymore. We're breaking up the ships. We're burning the plans.
Though he had done it all the way from China with a great fleet.
Right, which is why in the early 15th century, your money would have been on China. By the late 15th century, the Portuguese are sending much smaller ships much further, all the way around the Cape, the southern African Cape, to the Spice Islands of what is now Indonesia. And this sets off a competition, first between Portugal and Spain, later involving the Netherlands, England, the French. And this competition for trade routes and the profits that came from them, I think, is in many ways the starting point of the story. Another interesting point, which I think brings out the role of institutions in my argument, is that you already have in medieval Europe the first corporations, the Corporation of the City of London, which is a pretty much autonomous body governing the affairs of English merchants.
And you tie this into the competition of states, ultimately, the kind of sense that different bodies competing to get ahead, whether by design or just by the way Europe unfolded, that was an advantage.
And it is an advantage in the sense that it promotes technological innovation. There's a big incentive to make ships faster, nimbler, to make artillery more accurate. So that is part of the story, but it's only a part.
Then you have mathematics, astronomy, physics,
right.
Chemistry, biology.
The interesting thing about science, which is my second killer app, this is my jazzy way of trying to talk about institutions in a way that doesn't bore teenagers. So the second killer app was science. Now, China had had major advances in technology. The Islamic world in the 10th century was miles ahead of Europe. But
mathematics in particular.
Particularly, algebras from Al-Jabr, from the Arabic. But by the time you get to the 17th century, what we call the scientific revolution associated with the likes of Isaac Newton is an exclusively Western phenomenon. And it's the real paradigm shift. That's the fundamental change in our understanding of the natural world at every level, from the solar system down to the circulation of blood and even particles. And that didn't happen anywhere else. And that turned out to be a true killer app in the sense that, for example, and I show this
not least
in the
way it built militaries.
Yeah, if you apply Newtonian physics to ballistics, to artillery, gee whiz, you start hitting the target.
Rule of law and representative government, big on your list.
Killer app number three is a really interesting one. Some people say, well, why don't you say democracy? And my answer is because the rule of law is more fundamental than that. And the evolution of a system of law based on private property rights, which was particularly developed in the English-speaking world, I think was a real killer app. Because once you had that notion that an individual's personal freedom was bound up with his, and it was his in those days, ownership of property, you had the foundation for a very different kind of government, one in which the property rights of individuals were protected through a legislature. The original model of Parliament is an institution that gives property owners protection from the arbitrary power of the sovereign. This works pretty well in England, but it works supremely well when it's adopted by British colonists in North America.
Balances the power of the individual against the power of the state. You've got medicine in there. We'll look at that. But I want to get before the break to the rest of your list. The consumer society as a fundamental killer app of the West in its rise? What do you mean?
That sounds, by comparison with the scientific revolution, rather low. But actually,
have another Twinkie. That's really the source of power?
There's no point having an industrial revolution if you don't have a consumer society. The whole point of the industrial revolution is to lower the unit price of something like this white shirt I'm wearing. And that means you need the consumer society first. And the consumer society in the sense of mass consumption of textiles, the purchase of really quite large quantities of clothing, that starts first in the West. Elsewhere, consumption is something for elites.
Now people worry about where it takes us environmentally, but we'll come to that. And finally, the work ethic. You've got that sitting big in your list of
Absolutely.
Apps.
Absolutely. That's a really critical point, that 100 years ago it seemed clear that the work ethic was a peculiar phenomenon of Northern Europe and North America. And Max Weber, of course, associated it with Protestantism. I talk quite a bit in the book about religion. I don't wholly agree with Weber, but he was right in identifying a shift in behaviour, which meant that people not only worked longer hours, but they also worked more intensively, and they increased their productivity as they worked. And that, again, started in the West.
We're going to work back through this. I'm sorry to rush it, but I want to come to where you see all this going at this point. You're sitting there in China, where Chongqing now has 32 million people in Western China, kind of the outback, but it's booming too. And you're talking about decline of the West. You're talking even about the potential collapse of the West. We'll come back and look at that, if we may. Neil Ferguson is with us. His new book is Civilization, the West and the Rest. He likes the West. He likes, Mozart's Don Giovanni, not least.
Saw it just the other night.
Just the other night. Great, most perfect of all operas, 1787, from a high time in the West. What comes next? You can join the conversation this hour. Is the party over for the West? With China rising, India more, is the West headed for the backseat of history? And do you see decline, collapse? Is the whole world Western now? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook with Neil Ferguson in the studio. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about the fate of the West. Whether its long ascendancy is ending is over. Neil Ferguson is with me in the studio. It's interesting. I mean, you say, Neil, that we kind of fancy that if there's a decline, it's slow and we'll have a lot of time to work on it. But you look back at other empires, other dominant powers, and you say, don't count on that. The collapse can come quickly.
I think this is one of the more profound insights that I came to writing the book. It's very conventional to assume that things rise and reach a zenith and then gradually decline and finally fall, and this all takes some time. And I think that's the way we think about history, because that's the way human life is for us as individuals. Mm-hmm. But when you look at complex organizations, whether it be empires or, for that matter, corporations, they're much more likely to collapse very suddenly. They can be just fine for what appears a very long time. In fact, according to the theory of complexity, they're teetering on the edge of chaos, and it doesn't take an awful large perturbation to tip them over. And as I was writing the book, it struck me that when the West encountered rival civilizations, these rivals tended to fall off a cliff rather than to decline gradually. The Incas, for example, the Aztecs, they go down extremely fast, partly through disease, partly through conquest. The Ming dynasty implodes in the mid-17th century when it had seemed tremendously secure not long before. When I went back in time to look at Western Civilization 1.0, the Roman Empire, the interesting thing about the Roman Empire was that that fell apart in the West very fast in the early 5th century, in the space really of a few decades. And so the thought that occurred to me was that as we look at our own civilization, we should steer clear of the assumption that a gentle decline is all we have to worry about. That's why this book is not a declinist book. What I'm saying is that we should be much more worried about collapse than about decline.
But what does collapse mean in a time like this? I mean, in the early Roman Empire, Western Civilization 1.0, you call it, yeah, you had Visigoths coming over the walls. Now we're all tied in globalization. I mean, we are part of one, we're constantly reminded, and it is manifestly true, of one big economy. It's not like we've got, the Chinese wanting to, climb over a wall. They're trading with us, and we're trading with them, and India and all the rest. Our call centers are in Bangalore. This doesn't sound like a recipe for collapse. Aren't we all part of the same fabric now?
One of the interesting things about globalization is that we've created a highly optimized, highly complex global financial and economic system. And what we've already seen in the last 4 years is that such a system is indeed prone to collapse. Indeed, that's the nature of the financial crisis that we still find ourselves in. Or take a look at Europe. It's perfect for me that my book gets published just as governments are toppling in Athens and Rome.
The euro is wobbling all over the place.
That project to integrate Europe into a single monetary union is in fact unraveling at a terrifying speed. Really, only a few weeks ago, people assumed that Italy was fine, and then it wasn't fine. So the pattern that I'm pointing to is this non-linearity, the tendency for things to go wrong very fast when confidence is lost.
But what does not fine mean now in 2011? Well, for the Romans, in Europe, it meant the Dark Ages, right, followed. Are you really talking about that as a collapse, or is it just, okay, there's going to be austerity for, let's say, 10 or 20 years? In historical terms, that is not a Dark Ages.
Well, there are two tiers to this. First of all, austerity sounds innocuous here in the United States where it hasn't happened. Mm-hmm. But if you are in Greece or Ireland where you've just suffered, say, a 30% pay cut, and like my sister-in-law has just been made redundant in England,
laid off.
Made unemployed, then austerity actually has a pretty big impact. And the crisis of public finance, which I think is inherent in our Western problem, has major social implications. It involves far more draconian reductions in expenditure and far more painful macroeconomic shocks than most people in this country yet understand, because it hasn't begun here. Although, of course, it will, and in pretty short order, actually, when you look at U.S. public finances. But there's another level, Tom, which I think I'm really driving at, mm-hmm, beyond the sort of technicalities of bond markets and tax increases. The problem with this very complex system that we have, heavily dependent as it is on electronic communication, is actually quite vulnerable. One of the big areas of contestation between East and West right now, which we don't talk enough about or read enough about, is cyber warfare. I was in China recently in August. I talked to people who are actively involved in cyber attacks on Western governments and Western corporations.
But what would the Chinese gain be in a true takedown of the West? Wouldn't that just be cutting themselves off at the knees?
It's an extremely important card to have up your sleeve, just as we have an important card up our sleeves with respect to Iran. The possibility of completely closing down Iran's power grid, which I think is now really within the grasp of the U.S. It's a card that you can play. Now, in the strategic game that is unfolding now, the stakes are, I think, very high indeed. Whether you look at nuclear proliferation with the possibility of ultimate use of nuclear weapons, or just at this really interesting area opening up of cyber warfare, things go wrong in history. People miscalculate. Wars happen often by accident because everybody underestimates the downside risks of brinkmanship.
But we're not at sword tips with China. I mean, I really have to just sit on this for a minute, because it seems to me that this is not like the Goths coming over the walls of Rome.
No, but Tom, remember, a very important part of the story in Europe has been massive migration of non-assimilated immigrant groups, particularly from the Islamic world. I mean, go to the eastern end of Paris, go to the banlieue, and you will see a major powder keg of potentially severe ethnic conflict. When economic shocks hit multi-ethnic societies which haven't been well integrated, look out. So I think, although
are talking a Roman-style fall, old-fashioned Roman-style fall with barbarians through the gates.
Well,
in this
case, be very careful about using terms like barbarian, because I don't want to be misunderstood at all here, and it's very easy, as I've been discovering, to be misrepresented. The argument that I'm making is that,
well, but you do present it as a different culture that is somehow a threat to the Western.
Well, it's a very different
legacy.
Civilization.
Yes.
And those people who have created enclaves of multiculturalism, i.e. of Sharia law in parts of Western Europe, have created, I think, a very unstable situation. If the rule of law is different in certain parts of a country, you're already, I think, in dangerous territory. So I think we need to bear in mind that the potential for ethnic conflict in times of economic crisis has not gone away, and that the multi-ethnic cities that have been created in the Western world are not necessarily going to remain stable if economic growth remains as low as we're currently seeing.
The Economist magazine looks at your book. They're complimentary in many ways, but the bottom line seems to me, and of course it would be from The Economist, the way they see the world, but is, settle down, Neil Ferguson. Yes, the West is no longer alone at the top of the heap, but that's not such a bad thing. Many of the killer apps, as you describe them, the Western ways that drove its ascendancy have now just spread around the world. They write, whereas a handful of Western countries were once at it, a whole planet has started to join in. More likely than the end of civilization, this is The Economist editorial writing, and more boring is that the West will just cease to be special, that we'll just kind of all, muddle or magnificently, we'll go forward together here.
The problem with this argument is that even if the rest of the world consumed natural resources at only half the rate of the average American, that we would start running out of these resources within a remarkably short time frame. You don't need to have a view on climate change to recognize that the there's a mismatch between supply and demand here. As particularly Asian countries rapidly accelerate their economic growth and arrive at income levels not that far from ours, we are going to encounter major problems.
Maybe in that case it's a good thing that the Western culture driving consumerism is in retreat. Some would say, come on, let's roll back here a little bit, find another way. This is not sustainable if everybody picks up as the model.
Part of the argument I'm making is that in the end, westernization is the story, that most of the rest of the world has downloaded our killer apps. It began with Japan over 100 years ago. In our lifetimes, the Chinese have done it, Indians have done it, Indonesians have done it, and so on. And what we're seeing is essentially a westernization of institutions, particularly economic institutions. And the result is that, for example, of the 30 biggest shopping malls in the world, only 3 today are in the United States. Most are in the so-called emerging markets. So they are downloading our apps with great enthusiasm. The problem is that when you imagine a world in which more and more people, as the population approaches the 7, 8, 9 billion mark, are living American-style lifestyles, major problems are bound to arise. The Chinese are very well aware of that, which is why they're so aggressively accumulating claims on natural resources in Africa right now. We are much more complacent, and the economist's conclusion there is classically complacent. It's all going to be great because we're all going to essentially converge on one happy globalized lifestyle. I'm not so sure that's the way it's going to play out.
Lots of response for you. Neil Ferguson is with us, and his new book is Civilization, the West and the Rest. Here's Christos on Facebook, and he says, essentially saying that the West still has a lot of cards up its sleeve. He says, let the West make borders again, cancel a favored trade status for China's state-subsidized export goods, and the miracle of China's bubble collapses. In other words, we still have the Trump cards, I guess, in this.
It's a good point, Christos, that the potential for a trade war between the West and China is certainly there, and indeed it's been bubbling away in Congress now for some years. It's hard to say who would lose more. This interdependence between the U.S. and China, which I called Chimerica in my last book, The Ascent of Money, is beginning to look like one of those marriages that goes on the rocks. And although it's not quite divorce yet, there's certainly far more friction in the relationship than there used to be. Just look at China right now, and what you see is that they're having their own version of our property crisis, a real estate bubble that is bursting, yeah. A shadow banking system that is going down fast. I think most people have their minds focused on Europe right now, and they don't notice that there's a China crisis building. Maybe the Chinese have it under control. My impression is that it's a bigger problem than they've encountered so far in their transition to what is increasingly a market economy.
If everybody's got issues, maybe the West doesn't need to worry so much. Is it a zero-sum game even? I keep coming back to this. Does it have to be us or them?
Things are a zero-sum game if there's low growth, and that's what we're finding out in the West right now. If your society can't generate growth, then it is really an argument about a cake that isn't going to get bigger. Whereas, meanwhile, we've seen extraordinary growth rates in Eastern economies, and although China has slowed down, we're talking about a slowdown from 10% growth to 7 or 8% growth. If you project forward not very far, Tom, you end up by 2016, according to the IMF, with China as the biggest economy in the world. And I think the point that Christos is making in his posting is that China's system is quite different from ours. We shouldn't exaggerate the extent of institutional convergence. This is still a one-party state. Mm. It's still actually a pretty unfree society when it comes to expression, particularly of political mm-hmm. views. Mm-hmm. And the power that the party wields through state-owned organizations, state-owned companies, is really crucial. CIC, the Chinese Sovereign Wealth Fund, is the biggest investor in the world. It is a party-controlled institution. How it invests, the decisions that it makes, whether or not to hold U.S. treasuries, has a massive geopolitical significance to it. So we mustn't be Panglossian. It's rather fashionable at the moment to go around saying that everything's going to be just great. My good friend Steve Pinker has a book out which essentially says we're getting more and more peace-loving. We're all going to be
Stephen Pinker
family.
At Harvard, yes. We're on a good path here, a good
and
trajectory.
My position on that is that if you say stuff like that, you're tempting the historical fates, because it's usually just before something awful happens that people conclude that everything's going to be hunky-dory.
Historian Neil Ferguson is with us. His new book is Civilization, the West and the Rest. Let's go to our callers. Marshalltown, Iowa. David's calling. Hi, David. You're on the air with Neil Ferguson.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
Mr. Ferguson, I'm looking forward to reading your book. It sounds fascinating. I have a few very brief thoughts of factors that might come into this that haven't been mentioned yet. Number one, the dearth in population growth of the West. I think Pat Buchanan pointed that out a number of years ago, the fact that most Western nations don't even have a replacement value of children coming up of the onset of birth control and so on. That would be one. Number two, Social Security has been put out there as a Ponzi scheme, and in many ways, because we have so few children coming up, how are we going to take care of the folks like myself who are getting older, who have grown dependent on such a thing? And finally, the cultural glue that holds together, which is a belief not just in a right and wrong, but things such as truth and the abandonment of those. And I'll hang up and listen to your response.
David, thanks for your call. Well, Neil Ferguson?
Well, thank you, David. You raised some really important points here, which the book deals with at some length. The shift in demographics worldwide means that what was once roughly 20% of the population, the West, Westerners, Europeans and people of European origin settled in North America and elsewhere, used to be about a fifth of mankind. By 2050, it'll be less than 10%. Because birth rates have declined so far, particularly in European countries where you have extraordinarily low rates of reproduction. By the middle of this century, a third of the population of Italy will be 65 or over. Now, that just screams decadent society to me. And meanwhile, you have extraordinarily dynamic demographics in, for example, North Africa and the Middle East, where we see revolutionary events unfolding partly because of a tremendous youth bubble. I think that has massive implications, which the optimists are underestimating. As the so-called Arab Spring, greatly misnamed, unfolds, I think there's going to be a serious economic crisis, and that's when migration to Europe is likely to step up. Remember, when you ask young Egyptians what they actually want to do, the answer is they want to get out of Egypt.
Are you only comfortable with the world with Europe in charge, with the West in charge?
Oh, not at all.
Seems to be, well, you know, the population is growing there, so be worried here. The economy is growing there, so be worried here.
I think that's to simplify the argument. What I make very clear in the book is that I'm delighted to see China and India in particular emerging from centuries of stagnation. It's great to see these societies becoming economically free, if not, in the case of China, politically free. But we need to be aware of the problems that will be associated with this great transformation, this reconvergence of living standards, as I've already mentioned, in terms of the finite natural resources that we want to draw on. But also, I think, in terms of issues that David just raised, our welfare states are unsustainable. It's not really so much Social Security as Medicare that is going to bankrupt the United States without radical reform. And the same problem exists in all kinds of different forms in most developed countries, particularly in Europe. That's really the root of the crisis in Europe right now. Do we have the cultural glue? This was David's third point, to deal with the very difficult sacrifices that are going to have to be made. And I don't think we do. Certainly, there's not much sign of it in Europe right now.
Neil Ferguson's new book is Civilization, the West and the Rest. Listeners, you can join us. What do you see coming in this century? Is the great era of the West behind us? Can't we all just get along? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. A little Franz Schubert from String Quintet in C, a Ferguson favorite from the West here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the fate of the West, whether its long ascendancy is ending, is over. Neil Ferguson joins me in the studio. And Neil, lots of response here online. Let's see, what have we got? Here's one from the website. Says, I believe property rights were integral to the West's ascendancy. The problem now is the lack of ecological respect given to the benefits land affords, a kind of maybe chink in the armor of the property rights, one time, you say, pillar of strength. Here's another Shiva says, great topic, but is this really the decline of the West or the collapse of its economic model? Shiva writes, the West has to realize that its quarterly-based push-up-further economic growth model is not only unsustainable, but also against the ecosystem of nature. Eco rising there again once more. And here's another. Dan says, with the increasing compression of economic progress that results from growing worldwide population, dwindling resources, it seems to me that societies with more efficient central planning will succeed where more democratic societies will suffer. That's interesting. We've got Andy Stern, the big union leader, American union leader, SEIU. Retired there now, but was president for a long time. He's just come back from China and written in the Wall Street Journal that, you know, China's got the formula, and it's not the Western or at least the American formula of today exactly. They've got more state planning in there, and they're winning with it. He says, time to throw laissez-faire, market-driven everything out the window. It's not working.
I guess Andy didn't visit Wenzhou. Wenzhou is probably the most free market city in the world today, and it's become a byword for laissez-faire capitalism in China. We shouldn't simplify what is going on in China, and we shouldn't make it sound like a sort of revisited Stalinism. Yeah, there's a planned economy at the core of it, and particularly when it comes to infrastructure, the five-year plan is what's driving things. But wrapped around that is really a very, very dynamic market economy. And remember, if you look at the share that government takes of gross domestic product as a measure of the role of government, it's shrinking in China.
But you must see it as a different model from the American model.
Oh, it's certainly a different model, but I think the differences are actually greater in the political sphere than in the economic sphere, where they have essentially adopted a far more free market approach to really large segments of the economy. What's at the core, as I said, is a plan for infrastructure. Wrapped around that is essentially a free market economy in which Chinese firms compete for export market share in a way that is increasingly Western. If you actually go and visit Chinese companies, as I did in August and also earlier when I was researching this book, what's most striking is the speed with which, say, Li Fan Motors is converging on not just American but actually German standards. That's their objective, to get that good, not only the way that they produce, say, automobiles or motorbikes, but also the way that they run their finances. But I think there's a really important point to be made here, which goes to Shiva's point too. If there are environmental problems arising from our system, there are even larger environmental problems arising from theirs.
They're meeting in Durban right now. You look at the charts, China's emissions are leading the world right now. Right. On the other hand, through some of this state impetus, they're putting lots of money into solar energy, alternative energy of all kinds, way more than we are.
That's right. But in the short run, and I don't know how long that short run will be, it's the Chinese and, of course, the Indians who are opening coal-burning power stations every week and making probably, with almost certainly the biggest impact on the emission of greenhouse gases in the coming 50 years. So I think we have to be very careful here about leaping to the conclusion, as some people do, that there's some wonderful new Beijing model, the state capitalist model that we should all race to adopt. When you look at China, many of the problems that China will be grappling with demographically, environmentally, and socially are consequences of central planning. The one-child policy under Deng Xiaoping has created a potential disaster for China in terms of its own aging population and gender imbalances. And the environmental problems are not that different from the kind of problems that arose in the old Soviet system. Because with central planning, with the best will in the world, in fact, resources get misallocated. China has been on an almost crazy, unprecedented investment binge. It's one reason that the Chinese economy kept going when Western economies faltered in 2008-2009. But when you actually see the results of it, it's pretty awe-inspiring. People who haven't been to China, haven't traveled widely there, I think get a very, or have only been briefly, and I suspect this is true of Andy Stern. You know, you go to Beijing, go to Shanghai, you come home and you say, I've seen the future and it works. Guys, you do have to go to Chongqing. You have to go to Changsha. You have to travel more widely in this country. It's a fifth of humanity, for heaven's sake. The idea that we can understand this on a three-day visit is just absurd.
Steve in Auburn, Alabama. Steve, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Mr. Ferguson, I wanted to say I really appreciated your PBS special, and I'm going to try not to make a fool of myself in this conversation, but I just thought I'd throw in a couple of issues, see if you guys will bite at it. The first one is, I agree that using the scale and the definition that we're using here that America and the West is in a predicament, and we're having some growing pains that we're not necessarily adjusting to it well. But could it possibly be that the definitions that we're using for dominance, for growth, the whole nine yards, is still predicated on a model that is becoming less and less relevant? And with the advent of the Internet, the newer models of dominance, influence, and all these issues as far as cultural identity, national identities are all now being based not necessarily on geography or even tongue, but on viewpoints, on interests, on items you're looking for. That's my first question there.
That's a great one. And your second, Steve?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yes, please. Your second one?
Okay. The second one is that when we decide where we're at, because we've been knowing for over 15 years now that Brazil, Russia, India, and China were going to be the big economies, but by concentrating only on the economies, we tend to look at the numbers instead of the infrastructure. I grant you that China is a big monster right now, but I also grant you that worldwide China is not the most cherished country in the world, and its infrastructure, whether you're talking, like you said earlier, about the ecology or the cultural infrastructure, the government, all these issues does not say that China is organically viable in the long run.
Steve, let us pick it up right there. Those are two great big ones. A soft power, I guess you could say, Neil Ferguson, first, not smokestacks. Maybe that's the new way, Internet age. And then people repeatedly looking at China's weaknesses and saying, all right, yes, they got a lot of dynamism right now, but does that really mean they don't have big organic problems?
Steve, I think your first point about the way the Internet is transforming the nature of power itself is a great point, and it's one that I delve into in Civilization. I think what's very striking is to see how the Internet is affecting Chinese political life. There are two striking phenomena. One is that it has given the Chinese middle class, very rapidly growing, soon the biggest in the world, a mode of expression it didn't have before. And I saw that very clearly after the Wenzhou rail accident in the summer, when you had literally hundreds of millions of microblog postings criticizing the way the railways were run.
This is the high-speed rail that went right off the rails.
Mm-hmm. Right. And this became a real focal point for middle-class frustration with official corruption. Most people I spoke to quite openly blamed the accident on corruption within the rail ministry. The other interesting thing is that nationalism has in some ways been reinforced by the Internet. When I first asked the question, which is now 5 or 6 years ago, what will the Internet do to China? I thought the answer would be it'll make it more democratic. I think the answer is actually that it's becoming a tremendous channel for the transmission of nationalist feeling. And that slightly runs counter to your point, Steve, because I think you were saying, well, in a world of the Internet, it's one world.
And communities of interest that transcend national boundaries.
If you go and look online, say go to YouTube and look at some of the videos that have been made by Chinese students, not official videos, about issues like Tibet or Western media coverage of the Uyghur crisis, it's very striking how aggressively, stridently nationalist these video clips are. So I think we shouldn't leap to the conclusion that the Internet is going to dissolve national identity and create one enormous Facebook social network. I don't think that's the way the world is going. The other issue that you raise, I think, is absolutely right, and that is China's various weaknesses, particularly when it comes to what Joseph Nye, my colleague at the Kennedy School, calls soft power. Mm. China's not loved by its Asian neighbors. On the other hand, and this is something that I suspect President Obama underestimated when he went to that great Pacific conference
on his recent tour, mm-hmm.
and started to offer more military support to Australia. I think from the vantage point of, let's say, South Korea, if China is the most dynamic market for your exports, if China is really the engine of growth in the world economy and the U.S. is a faltering engine, then you don't need to love the Chinese to know that you need them.
And never mind in Africa, where it's Chinese investment that's pouring in, not otherwise.
It's very striking to see how much bigger the Chinese footprint is in Africa than the American footprint. And it's amazing. I went to Zambia earlier this year, and Zambia has been a classic case of large-scale Chinese investment and migration. There are a lot of Chinese there who are there almost speculatively trying to make some money. You can earn three times as a Chinese worker what you earn in China by going to Africa. And it almost looks like a process of unofficial colonization in some parts of sub-Saharan Africa.
Neil Ferguson, let's go right to the heart of what has been some very tough criticism of this book. People saying, look, you know, we're all humans on this planet. Yes, the West had a 500-year run, but it sounds, however you dress it up, it sounds like you're bemoaning the end of that. And why should that be bemoaned? You've had a very hot exchange with Pankaj Mishra, writing the London Review of Books. He says that you're defiantly loyal to a neo-imperialist vision. He reads Civilization, and he says the book exemplifies a mood at once swaggering, frustrated, vengeful, and despairing among men of a certain age, class, and education. I mean, what about the perspective here that says, wait a minute, West, you had 500 years on top, it wasn't all pretty, as you acknowledge in the book, there was a lot of very, very tough dominance in there. It wasn't all just kind of a natural floating, you know, paradise-like to the top. There was colonialism, there was blood and brutality. What about the view that says, so what?
Well, if Pankaj Mishra had actually read the book, which his review revealed that he didn't.
I know you've accused him of libel,
Well, I mean, I think this was an atrocious piece of writing, an irresponsible piece that should not have been published, which accused me of racism, and then, in support of that proposition, asserted a whole bunch of omissions that the book allegedly makes, which are, in fact, not omitted at all. The book explicitly disavows racial theories of Western predominance. On the contrary, I have really quite a large discussion of why racial theory was so poisonous as it became established in Western societies in the mid-19th century. I document at great length the consequences of racial theory for the Herero Nama people at the hands of their German masters. I think this misrepresentation of the book is just malice or possibly grotesque negligence, but it's certainly not, it doesn't belong in the realm of serious scholarly discussion.
But speak to this. Why does it matter, in some great cosmic sense, if the West is on top on this planet, if the East is on top of this planet, if it's some new melange? I mean, the West is, as you say at the beginning, you know, it started out as one little corner of a great landmass that came to be dominant.
But it's
speak
not
to the significance.
Yeah. But first of all, I don't bemoan this. I mean, I explicitly say at the beginning of the book, this is not a triumphalist account.
No, but you're accusing the West of sort of laziness and shiftlessness in letting it go. There is a very much a sense of it being bemoaned at some level.
Well, I mean, I think it'd be rather extraordinary to say that everything's just great and we should all chill, which it seems to be the thrust of what you're saying.
No, but
the book makes two points. One, the rest have essentially figured out what made the West successful and have copied much of what that was. It's an institutional, if you like, download. And I make the point that this downloading of the killer apps was always really going to happen since there was no particular way of preventing it. There's no reason the institutions shouldn't work as well in sub-Saharan Africa or in East Asia as they've worked in
Western Europe.
So
maybe that's a cause for celebration.
And that is and I say that. Mm-hmm. I explicitly say, mm-hmm. sorry, Mishra and other critics, at the end of the book, I say I highly welcome the exit from poverty of the majority of the world's inhabitants. I celebrate that. But the other part of the story is we need to look at what's going wrong within the West. Those six institutions that I began by describing, mm-hmm. ranging all the way from competition through science, the rule of law, medicine, the consumer society, and the work ethic, they are not what they were. Take just for one example, mm-hmm. the rule of law. Our legal institutions do not work as well as they used to. We've gone from the rule of law, you might say, to the rule of lawyers.
Influence.
And there are there is evidence, which troubles me greatly, of a kind of corruption of the political system and the legal system in ways that are at the very least going to be deleterious to economic growth, but also to social stability. Am I bemoaning that?
You've got kind of Occupy Wall Street sympathy here.
I have sympathy with the argument that something has gone wrong, mm-hmm. that inequality is a manifestation of that, but I don't have sympathy with the rather naive view expressed by Occupy Wall Street that we can solve all this simply by racking up tax rates on the top 1%. Globalization is one reason for widening inequality, and globalization, it seems to me, has to be center stage for any discussion of what is happening. Why is it that the bottom quintile in this country has stood still or even declined? It's got far more to do with the impact of Asian competition than the malice of people at Goldman Sachs. And that's what Occupy Wall Street fails to, I think, understand and articulate.
So what's the way back for the West? You are kind of prescribing here. I mean, you say that the greatest dangers facing us are not China or Islam or CO2 emissions. You say, I'm quoting you here, is the greatest danger, our own loss of faith in the civilization we inherited from our ancestors. So is that it? Back to reading Shakespeare and Aristotle and
Well, it's certainly necessary for us to look very hard at the institutions that used to work so well in the West and ask ourselves what we can do to improve them. This is another sense in which this isn't a declinist book. I'm saying we can fix these problems because they're institutional. The fact that
don't have forever. Collapse is out there as a possibility.
We have to get on with it. We can't simply say, oh, this is a problem for 2050, leave it to the next generation. We have to address these issues right now. And we have to recognize that complex things like the way in which the rule of law operates need to be attended to. This is not part of the debate. We also need to attend to the fact that our public schools, especially in poorer areas, are failing to deliver numeracy and literacy to a big chunk of our population. Just look at the OECD PISA scores. There's now a gap in attainment in mathematics between Shanghai and the US as big as the gap between the US and Albania at age 15. That kind of institutional problem, the basic failure of our public high schools, is not getting enough airtime. And I could go on. It seems to me that wherever you look, we have signs of institutional sclerosis, of institutional degeneration, and we are not addressing these problems. On the contrary, the political debate seems to wander ever further from the issues that are really central to my critique. So this is a book much more of self-criticism of the West than it is of the alleged triumphalism of that abysmal piece by Pankaj Mishra.
Neil Ferguson, author of the big new book, Civilization, the West and the Rest. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Neil Ferguson, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for your comments and calls. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gale-Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Amata, Alex Kingsbury, Stefano Katsonis, James Ross, and Dean Russell. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.